From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a little Detroit girl killed in an alley by a pack of pit bulls, raising questions about the city's animal control efforts.
Animal control is still understaffed, still open only 10 to 3 every day. And you try to call it. Call the number now and see if you get an answer. You get a busy signal.
Detroit Animal Care and Control failed this little girl and her family tremendously. My heart is broken for her.
Teachers responding to the problems of their students who are homeless.
I personally, as a teacher, I remember one time going in and doing a student's laundry for, you know, once a week.
A film festival honors the history of a West Michigan town that was a vacation spot for black families.
Idlewild was one of the very few places where African Americans were allowed to just basically be themselves and not have to worry about segregation.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later in the program, how a new approach to philanthropy in Ann Arbor could be a model for some other Michigan cities. But first, 9-year-old Emma Hernandez should be getting ready for fourth grade. But on Monday, this little girl was killed by 3 dogs as she rode her bike near her Detroit home. The dog's owner has been arrested and is expected to be charged today by the Wayne County prosecutor. The 3 pit bulls are expected to be euthanized. Emma's hideous death has put the spotlight on the problem of dangerous dogs, careless owners, and the City of Detroit's animal control operations. We began with Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley, who wrote an editorial titled "Detroit Must Rid Itself of Killer Dogs." Nolan, you're right, the city has a problem with pit bulls. Where do you think the city should focus its efforts to prevent future attacks?
I don't think the focus should be entirely on pit bulls. It should be on dogs in general, and the way they're being treated in Detroit and bred in Detroit, and the irresponsible ownership of animals in Detroit. And I think there are a lot of issues to consider there. I mean, you have dogs that are chained up all day, serving as watchdogs, supposedly not socialized, not used to the to interacting with people, not used to high stress situations, and then when they get loose and encounter that, they act like dogs act. I mean, they're wild animals. You have dogs being taken away from their mothers too early and misused and abused. So there are a lot of problems. I think the problem is as much with ownership, the owners, as it is with the dogs. You hear from people all the time who say, my pit bull is loving and wonderful, mm-hmm. and yet you have all these incidents in Detroit with pit bulls.
And as you do write, it should be prompt a sweep of the entire city to round up and destroy
right.
every dangerous dog. So dangerous dogs
true.
Of any breed?
All breeds.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got dogs sitting out there and you see it all the time, chained to a post, sitting on top of a little doghouse or a little platform of some sort, no grass, mm-hmm. feces all around it, you know,
yeah.
dogs in horrible conditions who will react terribly to stressful situations they're not used to processing.
Nolan, you're hard on Mayor Mike Duggan, on Police Chief James Craig, mm-hmm. and Governor Whitmer for not going to the scene of this young girl's death. A lot of kids in Detroit are dying from violence of all kinds. Should this case get more specific attention from our leaders?
Because of the horror of it. I mean, can you imagine what she suffered in those last minutes of her life?
Mm-hmm.
This child was eaten by dogs on a major American city. And if you're outside of Detroit reading about this, hearing about this, what's your impression of a city where this happens? Not just once, but twice in 3 years, and then you've had other people attacked and maimed and mauled by dogs. What image does that create in your mind about this city? They should be on in that neighborhood today, or they should have been there yesterday, saying, we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. Happened 3 years ago with 4-year-old Xavier Strickland, got eaten in front of his mother by 4 pit bulls. And the city then said, this kind of thing shouldn't happen again. And here we are, because nothing has changed. Animal control is still understaffed, still open only 10 to 3 every day. And you try to call it. Call the number now and see if you get an answer. You get a busy signal. And so we have this menace in our community that we're not taking seriously. Kids are going to be walking to school here in a couple of weeks, and I mentioned that in the column.
Yeah.
And you talk to mothers, and they're terrified on behalf of sending their children out on the sidewalks because there are so many dangerous dogs in the city.
Nolan, you write, and I'm going to quote you here, if we can shrug and go on this time, if her death becomes a one-day story, if nothing is done to make sure our children are safe from killer dogs, then we can't call ourselves a civilized city. That reads a lot like something we would have read after a shooting. What, if anything, do you see as the difference between banning dogs or restricting dogs or restricting guns?
You know, you look at the viciousness of this, and, I mean, she wasn't swimming in an ocean and a shark got her. She wasn't in, you know, the wilds of the mountains and a cougar got her. She was riding her bike on the streets of a major city, and dogs tore her apart. I guess the viciousness of this, I think it's a disgrace that this could happen.
But bullets fly through alleys, too. And it's vicious.
But they fly through every city, you know. And of course, the random shootings, the drive-by shootings, also should disgrace us. But there's something in my mind particularly heinous about a child being pulled from a bicycle and torn apart and eaten alive. I mean, that's beyond my comprehension.
But do you feel that there's any way to effectively regulate dog ownership or regulate dangerous dogs that does not involve rounding them up?
I think there are a lot of dogs that should be rounded up. But I think we have ordinances on the books. We have a lot of ordinances already. We have a lot of laws in place. You mentioned guns earlier. It's similar to the fact that we have a lot of gun laws in place. They do no good unless we enforce them. And we're not, you know, dogs are supposed to be registered in Detroit. They're not. There's a law on the books in Detroit that a dog can't be chained in the yard more than 3 hours at a time. Who's enforcing that law? Nobody. We have plenty of laws. We just don't enforce them.
Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley. Nolan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
We turn now to Teresa Sumter, director and founder of the Detroit Pit Crew Dog Rescue. This group picks up strays from Detroit and Highland Park. Teresa, you know very well what happened to little Emma Hernandez this week, and then in 2015, 4-year-old Xavier Strickland, both children attacked and killed by pit bulls. Nolan Finley of the Detroit News is calling for a sweep of the city and a crackdown on dangerous dogs and careless owners. Now we got people on social media weighing in. For instance, one post, someone said, I'm tired of hearing about what gentle, wonderful dogs they are. They're not. They're bred for fighting. What do you think about all of this?
Well, I think that this is not a breed problem. I think that this is definitely a people problem.
And why do you say that?
Well, I mean, we work in a city that is home to, you know, thousands and thousands of dogs. Obviously, it's a very large city. It's 139 square miles. It's home to 672,000 people. I would say conservatively, there's at least a quarter of a million dogs with owners in the city of Detroit, and probably 90% of those are pit bulls. We also have thousands of pit bulls running the streets, and we do not hear about maulings on a daily basis. So we know this is not a breed problem. It is a people problem. It's a lack of enforcement, and it is a lack of response from the city. When calls do come through and stating that these are vicious dogs, these dogs need to be removed, or something needs to be done, we are not getting the response necessary to ensure the safety of the community.
Nolan mentioned that, too, about phones just ringing and ringing and going unanswered.
That's correct.
And he is calling out city leaders and even the governor to take action so we don't have another child lost to a dangerous dog. What should the city be doing that it's not?
There's just so many problems in the city of Detroit, but we really need to have more enforcement. And I mean, I myself get calls about dogs that are out vicious, running around, own dogs that are scaring the community. When I turn those over to Detroit Animal Care and Control, or DACC, and I send them an email and I say, hey, there is an issue here. Can you guys please respond to this? You know, our organization is not set up to pick up vicious dogs. We're here to pick up stray dogs that are injured or sick. We need your assistance on this. We can't even get a response from them. I have police officers contacting us, say, hey, we need help coming and getting these vicious dogs because Detroit Animal Care and Control is not responding. I have police officers calling and telling me that they have picked up dogs and brought the dogs over to DACC, and nobody will answer the door. And they are supposed to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to the police department. So what are we supposed to do with this? And who do we blame? Right now you have DACC, an organization that's supposed to be run by the city. It has no leader. There's no director right now at Detroit Animal Care and Control, nor do they have a vet on staff. So who is running this place? Who is in charge of making sure that these calls are going through and being properly responded to? There is nobody. And then when we move up the chain to the health department, because DACC is under the command of the health department, you have nobody in charge there. It's like, where do you even go with this? If you're a regular citizen and you live in the city of Detroit and you do have vicious dogs running around and you call animal control, first of all, if they even pick up, they'll tell you they have a 48 to 72 hour response time. And maybe they will and maybe they won't show up. By then, what kind of damage have those animals done?
Hmm. And Nolan Finley talked about this cultural problem in Detroit around these dangerous dogs. And you are out there, Teresa Sumter, in the alleys, in the yards, in the streets. What do you think? What do you see?
I see a lot of irresponsible owners. I have turned in numerous people and said, these dogs are not in a good situation. This is not good for the community. Can I please get some help here? And it is extremely difficult to get any assistance in these situations. You know, when people call me now, I say, well, if the dog is chasing people or if you're fearful of the dog, please call 911. Don't even call animal control. Call 911, and hopefully they have the time to respond. But, you know, this is the city of Detroit. So in Detroit, you have other issues going on that present community, you know, risks, and so those officers have to respond to the most urgent cases first. So we all understand that. And they're not in charge of picking up vicious dogs. That is animal control. And Detroit Animal Care and Control failed this little girl and her family tremendously. My heart is broken for her and her family.
What do you hope might come out of this tragedy of Emma Hernandez?
Well, I would like to see more enforcement. I would like to see that when we know that there are dogs that are vicious, that they are removed. And it's not the breed. Look, there's all sorts of breeds of dogs in the city of Detroit. I see a lot of vicious dogs. It is not just pit bulls. And when we know that a dog presents a danger, that needs to be addressed by the proper authorities.
Teresa Sumter, director, founder of the Detroit Pit Crew Dog Rescue. Teresa, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We received a statement from Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan's office that reads, in part, I quote here, "It is not acceptable to have dangerous animals loose on the streets of Detroit. DPD and Animal Control are reviewing the entire issue to make certain the city will do everything possible to prevent this type of tragedy from ever occurring again." You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are more than 36,000 students in our state, in Michigan, who do not have a home. That's according to the latest data. As the new school year approaches, just how do these kids succeed in school when they don't have a home? And how should teachers respond to students who are homeless? Michigan Radio's education commentator, Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz, is back now with us. Michigan has one of the largest populations of homeless students, according to Poverty Solutions at the University of Michigan. Matinga, how do schools handle this?
Well, first of all, let's establish that not only is this a heart-wrenching problem for schools, but that any one of us can become homeless. We are all a medical bill away or a tornado away from becoming homeless. So this is not necessarily like this is their fault problem. This is just a life problem.
A
let's
fine
establish
point.
That to begin with.
Yeah, that's a fine
right.
point.
You know that when our economic problems in our state get a cold, our schools get pneumonia. Like it is, the classroom especially gets pneumonia. And so teachers have to completely change the way that they approach kids who are homeless or kids who are suffering from trauma based on poverty.
And how do they do that?
Well, here's the interesting thing that I found. The teachers don't want to talk about this. It's really difficult. I think it's out of humility. A lot of them are doing things that, you know, they might feel like, well, you know, I don't really want my district to know because I don't want this to be like, okay, and the expectation. So teachers have a really hard time talking about this. You have to really pull teeth to get them to talk about it. But what things that the teachers are doing is, you know, teachers often do things like, you know, they do laundry. They will do things like, you know, I personally, as a teacher, I remember one time going in and, you know, doing a student's laundry for, you know, once a week, or they will volunteer to do things like run the washing machines at the schools, or ask the school systems to open showers for the kids. And of course, we have a supply closet of stuff for kids who are just furthest from opportunity.
How about academically? What are the challenges of doing well in school when you are a student who is homeless?
Well, we all know students who beat the odds and they get out of poverty and they do well in life. But we know that that is the exception and not the rule. And so the current school system is really set up for kids who have a stable living environment, they have a family support, and their success really is very much dependent on these factors. Students of poverty, of course, often have to work. They have siblings to take care of. They have to step in for parents who work. And let's establish this too, that it's not sometimes that the parents are not working. It's that the parents have, you know, minimal paying jobs and makes it so that housing is not affordable in the area where the kids are living. Students are often very afraid of creating relationships because they're afraid of moving and, you know, like losing those connections. And of course, like you said at your beginning, you know, how are you doing homework when you don't have a home per se? And I think the saddest thing is that often the students are sick and we are encouraging them to stay home when they're sick. Well, when you're couch cruising in somebody's house, going home is not an option. And I think the most tragic thing about this is that, you know, they are at greater risk of not meeting those grade level standards, which increases their opportunity to drop out.
So what to do? What kinds of solutions have you seen that work in helping these students?
Well, you know, a lot of the solutions require, because the problem is not the homeless student. The problem is the system. And so we have a current culture of ranking students. And so all of the resources are always thrown towards making sure those students meet this artificial mark. And so if we would just turn around and become more humane about kids who are needing a better opportunity, we would find that the solution is already in our hands. Find that some of the schools that are, for example, providing these progressive school cultures that allow students to talk and share their experiences without judgment. I see that some schools they stop talking about this idea of teaching the kids grit, because hard work does not always work for students furthest from opportunity.
Matanga, it strikes me if schools could provide a homework center, so a student would have a place with internet access and a nice secure place and a calm place to do homework, that could go a long way, couldn't it?
It does. And for many of these kids, school becomes the one stable element, like I said at the beginning. And so the schools are going out of their way to make sure that the students have not just a time at home, I mean, after school, but also time during the school day to make sure that they're getting what they need. So, you know, schools are trying to meet this population. But remember, in a school of 1,000, they could be, you know, a couple hundred kids who are homeless or at least struggling with unstable home life. So it's a lot of kids. It's not just the one kid who gets to go to the library and then get his homework done.
I'm wondering how the presence of a student who is at a shelter or who is couch surfing, how that impacts other students. And by that, I'm wondering, it seems like it could be a double-sided coin, an opportunity to create empathy and maybe increase understanding, but sometimes kids don't listen to their better angels. And do you ever hear of or worry about homeless students being subjected to teasing and bullying?
It is. And again, a lot of these things are systemic. I mean, we as a school sometimes have this culture of, you know, providing that peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch for the kids who are not able to, whose parent cannot pay for the bill for the month. And then you have to parade through the cafeteria with that peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And, you know, and you hear of stories of schools who are going you know, extra lengths to humiliate and stigmatize these students further. But again, there are schools who are doing things like, you know, hey, you can cook your own lunch. You can create, you know, there's a snack closet, et cetera, to make it so that it's less painful. And yeah, students are going to get teased whether they're homeless or whether they're rich. But what you said is very important. It's the students can provide a positive impact if we just create some of those systemic changes, because these students come from a perspective that creates that empathy and that altruism. And really, it humanizes the homeless. And when the students see them as human, they're more likely to want to be part of the solution rather than being part of the problem.
Matinga, in your career as a teacher, have you seen students who are homeless overcome that challenge to the point of going on to academic and professional success, where they can break that cycle of homelessness and poverty?
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. And I've seen, and again, I was in a large school, but I want to emphasize that these kids are the exception. And I've seen students come in to my class lost. They've joined the military and then become, you know, they come back and they're yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And I've seen students start their own businesses right when they were 16 at school and be able to support their own families. And so especially when the age of AI and the age of technology, kids are finding that maybe the school system is not what they need. What they need is an opportunity to be entrepreneurial, and the schools just help them do that.
Michigan Radio's education commentator, Matinga Rigotz, shedding some light on the challenges facing students who are homeless. Matinga, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The small northwest Michigan town of Idlewild once meant fun and vacation for African Americans. Idlewild was the place where black families could enjoy a vacation that was free from the constraints of racist segregation. Filmmaker Tinesha Brignone is putting the spotlight back on Idlewild with an international film festival that's going to happen August 23rd, 24th, and 25th. So let's find out about this festival. Tinesha, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me today.
So this is the inaugural festival, first time out. What gave you the idea to do this festival and to do it in Idlewild?
Well, I actually visited Idlewild last year for the first time, did not know there was a real Idlewild. The only Idlewild I had ever heard of was from the movie with Andre, I believe his name is Andre 3000. Mm-hmm. And I went there for a summer glamping trip and just noticed how beautiful it was there. Coming from Detroit, I don't get to experience a lot of nature. So it was just like a getaway from the city, and the atmosphere was just so serene. I had a wonderful time. I actually ended up shooting a short film called With Love from Idlewild, and it was a very spontaneous short documentary that I filmed. And so after I filmed that, you know, I submitted it to a few film festivals. It got into the Marshall Film Festival up north, and then it made it into the Free Press Film Festival. And the last festival so far is the Asian African Diaspora Festival in Cincinnati, Ohio. Getting back to the film festival.
Yeah.
While I was working on the movie, I decided, well, I had already thought about doing a film festival. I just didn't know where. And so when I got to Idlewild, I realized they didn't have, you know, a lot of infrastructure. They didn't have a lot of media arts programs. There's just not a whole lot going on there. And so I decided that would be a great place to just launch a film festival. I know it's crazy. Like, who would want to put a film festival in a rural part of Michigan? Well, I guess that would be me.
Well, when did you become aware that, oh my goodness, this is the Idlewild where so many, black families came to seek some vacation and do exactly what you're doing, commune
exactly.
with the North?
Yeah, I did not realize that until after I got back home, and I had, you know, had like a just a little brief intro to Idlewild from a friend who brought me there.
Yeah.
But I started doing research. I was just so captivated that I started doing research, and I started coming across a lot of footage. I came across this, I think it's called like nature porn or something like that, or obstruction. I can't think of the name of it. So basically they go around and they look for like dilapidated buildings and they kind of expose them on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And so what they were showing was not my experience there. And so I wanted to kind of, you know, frame a different story. So I took the footage that I had and I just started arranging it as I saw Idlewild in my own, you know, image through my eyes. And again, the film festival just came from that whole short film and just wanting to, you know, show the community of Idlewild this short film.
Yes.
And then I realized that, hey, you know, there's not a lot of women film festivals in Michigan. It would be nice to have a women's film festival. And then it became a women's international film festival. And then it just kept growing from there.
So good ideas just keep growing.
Yes.
So give us an idea, Tanisha, what is on tap for those 3 days? What do you have scheduled?
Okay, so the film festival itself is actually Friday and Saturday, and then there's an award ceremony, which is like a private ceremony that Sunday. And it's on the festival grounds, Lindsay Park or Paradise Lake Festival grounds. In terms of the films, I have films from all over the country. I have a film from Malaysia, Kenya, Cuba. I have two films from Cuba, which are absolutely just very exciting. They're subtitled films. But I decided that I would just go ahead and show them because, you know, hey, you can still learn a lot, you know, reading subtitles. I love subtitled films personally.
What's the film that speaks to you, that really, really resonates to you with you? I know, I'm asking you to pick one.
let me think. I believe it's called, there's actually two. The one that is from Cuba is Basuco Afro-Cuban Beats, I believe it's called, or Basuco. My Spanish is terrible. And that one basically touches on the importance of cultural relevance. So it kind of talks about different music and how they evolved and things like that, which I'm really heavy into, like music and origins of music.
Bacoso es eso. Son las calles santiagueras, la conexión entre África, el Caribe y Cuba. Porque Bacoso somos nosotros.
Bacoso, se baila en la calle.
Bacoso,
se escucha en la casa.
Bacoso,
hasta los niños.
Bacoso,
que lo traigo yo.
Bacoso,
se baila en la calle.
Bacoso.
And then there's another film that's actually from my hometown, which is Detroit, and that's called Side Lots. That's a very important film for the festival. It talks about reclaiming the land, and it also talks about, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but basically it's very nature-centered, which I thought was appropriate for Idlewild.
Give us a sense of just what this town meant to African Americans when it was, you know, in the 20th century, when it was its vacation heyday.
Well, Idlewild was one of the very few places where African Americans were allowed to just basically be themselves and not have to worry about segregation and the horrors that came with it. So people, regardless of what, you know, their status was able to go and blend in and, you know, just have a good time, relax. There was a lot of parties. There was a lot of hanging out on the beach, I guess, horses, people would ride horses, fishing, all those wonderful things that people still enjoy today. One of the main things that I find important about Idlewild is all the history in terms of the entertainers that frequent there. Aretha Franklin, Della Reese, Cab Calloway, I believe, frequent there, a whole list of other people that I can't recall. And so that was their haven where they could go and just relax and just, you know, connect with their own people and not have to worry about being treated like a second-class citizen.
Yeah, I've seen some, you're right, Lena Horne and the Four Tops. There were some, as you say, big, big names that made it up to this little town in Michigan.
Exactly. And a lot of us from Michigan don't even know about it. So, you know, I kind of made it my mission to let people know about it or inform people about it. I've been doing a lot of speaking engagements, just telling people about Idlewild and trying to get people to come up there and kind of reclaim the land. There is not a lot of infrastructure there, which is why we're having an outdoor film festival, which I know it's very risky because we live in Michigan and the weather is iffy. But I definitely felt like it was worth the risk. And we also have an indoor venue, which will take place inside one of the, it's like a community building. They do not have a theater. So there's like this really large community building that we are making into a screening room. And we've been getting assistance from a lot of organizations, including the Detroit Institute of Arts, Oakland University, Spin Inc., which is in Detroit. Just a lot of people have joined us in making this happen.
I'm interested why, Tanisha, you decided to make this an international festival instead of, I'm going to use air quotes here, an African-American festival.
Yes, I'm glad you asked me that. Because I really feel like with just the history, there's a number of reasons, but with just the history of the segregation and, you know, things like that, I feel like it's important that we kind of evolve as a nation
And I would love for Idlewild to be sort of a meeting place where people from all nationalities and ethnic groups could come together and, you know, just join and enjoy media, enjoy films. And also another thing is that I feel like people don't get to travel a lot. And this is a way that they are exposed to other cultures. So by being exposed to other cultures, we learn that we're not so different after all. So it's kind of, you know, my way of educating people without them knowing. But I guess I just told them.
Well, the Idlewild International Film Festival, again, it happens August 23rd, 24th, and 25th. And all the details, all the screening schedules are right there on the website, IdlewildIntFilmFest.com. And we have been talking with the filmmaker and the organizer of this inaugural film festival. We've been talking with Tanisha Brignone. It's been fun talking with you, and good luck. And let's hope that the sun shines and the skies are clear at night and you don't have any rain.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We here at Stateside are always on the hunt, looking for good stories, and so we turn to you. What story out there has caught your interest? Or who are the people doing something special in your corner of the state that you think we should know about? It's very easy to let us know. You can email us. Just write stateside@michiganradio.org. We're on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio, and Twitter, @StatesideRadio. And of course, you can go to the Stateside page at MichiganRadio.org and click the link that says Stateside. It's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Exactly just who invented the internet and the personal computer, well, that's still kind of up for debate. But people pretty much agree that a member of the Gaylord High School class of 1932 is the father of computing. Let's learn more now about Michigan's computing pioneer. State archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, is here with us. So, Mark, we hear names like Tim Berners-Lee, Steve Wozniak, Vincent Cerf, and going further back, maybe English mathematician George Boole, all linked with the birth of the internet or the PC. But tell us, who is Michigander Claude Shannon?
Claude Shannon, as you said, grew up in Gaylord, was born in Petoskey, and he was a mathematician and electrical engineer by education, and he really took a lot of what people like Boole and others, he synthesized, and then I think a lot of those other later people that you mentioned really took what Claude Shannon created and cracked the door open to create the internet communication system that we have today.
Interesting. Did I understand, too, he's a distant cousin of Thomas Edison?
So the story goes, yes.
So he founded information theory.
Yeah, that's really vague, I think at least for me. It's like, so when you drill down into what he actually did, when he left Gaylord, he went to University of Michigan. And when he went to graduate school at MIT, his master's thesis centered on digital circuitry. So this is 1937. And I don't think we really had digital circuitry in 1937.
I don't think so.
Ahead of his time. Most computers then were analog computers. They were mechanical computers that would solve mathematical problems. And here is Claude Shannon talking about, in his thesis, how information can be shared electronically. You know, he combined his mathematics and his electrical engineering into this theory that information could be shared across electrical circuits. And that's why places like Bell Labs were really interested in this technology. It's because they didn't want to have people having to manually switch circuits. You know, the old phone boards that you saw in the old movies, they wanted to make that automated. So that's why Bell Labs is interested in this technology.
So this idea that, you know, you're using electrical switches to implement logic, that's like the whole basis of all of this, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And that's why you see that moving forward into World War II and cryptology.
Yes, because I understand what he worked with British cryptographer and mathematician Alan Turing of Bletchley Park fame.
He did. So going into the war, he cracks open the idea of digital circuitry, the non-analog way of computing. And then coming out of the war, it wasn't until, I think, 1948 or 49 that their work was declassified, he then introduced that idea that information could be communicated in simple means like in ones and zeros, which if you took your basic class in middle school, for those of you that even know what that is, ones and zeros make perfect sense.
That's amazing. And what else did he do? I mean, he was an inventor as well.
Yeah, he had a fun side to him as well. So we don't have enough time to list all of the awards and medals and publications. I think he was credited with over 120 research publications. But as he was inventing, he would prove his theories through some fun means. He had a electrical mouse to demonstrate digital circuitry. He had a mouse that could navigate a maze electronically. It was a mechanical mouse. He also was known to ride around Bell Labs on a unicycle. So he was like one of the first people to ride around the office on a bike, but it was a unicycle.
Okay.
And he was also an avid juggler. He even had a theorem for juggling.
A theorem, meaning you could apply mathematics
like a formula.
To juggling.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a physics formula so that you and I can juggle too. I don't understand a word of it, though.
What happened in his later years?
He was in Massachusetts because of his work at MIT, and he stayed there later in life. I think it's important to note he tried to credit her, but I don't think she really got the credit due. His wife, Betty, was one of those analog computer operators because early on, pre-World War II, it was often women that were doing that manual computing, and then especially in World War II, they filled the workforce even more. But she is credited on most of his later research. She was a research partner. He considered her an equal. She just never gets the billing he does, as much as he's tried to list her in his publication. Mm. So I think she was with him till the end. He later developed Alzheimer's and passed away when he was 84 in Massachusetts.
In fact, as I read up on him, I saw that he really was kind of oblivious to everything that he had helped create in this digital revolution in those final years.
I don't know if that's just him being humble or if he truly didn't connect it. I tend to think it's the former.
And he is widely accepted and celebrated for really being the person who laid the cornerstone for the digital revolution?
In the information community, I think he is, but that's a pretty small community. I think most people on the street wouldn't know who Claude Shannon is. If you look at a picture of him, he sort of looks like an actor. He's a very, very striking person, sort of reminds me of Gregory Peck. But I don't think anyone would recognize a picture of Claude Shannon either.
Putting the spotlight on the story of Michigan's pioneering mathematician, the father of information theory, Claude Shannon, once again, the Gaylord High School class of 32, who went on to probably definitely make that phone we use, that little computer that we can't live without, possible.
That's right.
State archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Always great talking to you, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
If you're a promising and successful tech startup, you owe it to your community to give back. That's what Doug Song believes. Doug is the co-founder of Duo Security, the Ann Arbor-based tech company sold to Cisco last year for $2.35 billion. Doug has made it possible for other tech entrepreneurs in Washtenaw County to give back by launching the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund. So let's talk about this as we welcome Doug Song back to Stateside. Good to have you back, Doug.
Thank you.
And we want to welcome Neil Hajra, who's president of the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation. It's going to manage the fund. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, Doug, just tell us, what is the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund? What's the challenge and to whom is it directed?
Sure. So the idea of the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund is that there's been a lot of startup value created in Ann Arbor and the surrounding region, but not a lot of it has been captured by the community, frankly. I think over the past decade or even more than that, we've had an average of about $200 million in startup exit value created every year. That's actually excluding Duo. And so a meaningful percentage of those entrepreneurs that were involved with that, as well as a lot of the employees, have been very successful. And many tend to be fairly young, right? Between the age of maybe 30 and 50 or so. And so as a result, I think a lot of them haven't really begun a lot of their philanthropic activity. And while it's great to give back, it would be better to give first. And with the opportunity to have equity and ownership in a company held in a fund so that as the companies grow, the value of that equity does for the community, I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us to be more proactive in how we might, again, align the interests of that kind of growth with the community.
And get started when people are younger, not wait until they're long established and much older and down the pike in their careers.
Absolutely.
What is it you're asking tech startup founders to donate? You're giving people some options here?
Yes. Yeah, so the way that the Entrepreneurs Fund is currently set up is either 1% equity of the company or a percent of profits. And for that, what companies get are the opportunity to really participate in the community. One thing we've also seen, other regional hubs such as Austin, Boulder, Colorado, or the Bay Area do, is also get the broader employee base of those companies involved in service and find opportunities for, again, the broader companies to participate in really a third pillar of giving, which is also time. And so that's something that, again, we're still exploring, but hopefully we'll be able to benefit the community in a very direct way.
Neil, how is this different from what we consider to be the traditional foundation?
Sure. That's a good question. So the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation is actually a collection of permanent funds. We're a foundation that's by the people and for the people of Washtenaw County. So we're really a great platform for Doug's vision and seeing it through. The big difference is in Michigan, to our knowledge, there hasn't been any other arrangements where entrepreneurs are committing 1% of equity or 1% of annual profits to grow a fund. And really, the new idea here is linking business success to community success in a very tangible way. And years after entrepreneurs may exit and either stay or move on, the fund that they're investing in through their commitments will keep giving to the community. And we want there to be that very tangible link between what our growing entrepreneurial community is doing in the Ann Arbor area and the broader benefits for Washtenaw County.
And what might that look like? What kinds of things do you hope could be done with the kinds of money that you could make with either the donation of profits or the equity?
Sure. So, you know, we specialize in improving the quality of life in Washtenaw County, and that's definitely a value held by all the entrepreneurs we're talking to. So the main tool we would use is grant making. As the fund grew, it would start granting out to nonprofits around specific causes or initiatives or efforts that entrepreneurs collectively said they wanted to invest in. But as Doug mentioned, there's also an opportunity to engage these tech entrepreneurs and their employees in service, and therefore you're creating your new generation of board members, your new generation of engaged donors. And I'll also mention a lot of these entrepreneurs have a lot of skills in the back office and execution in an enterprise that could really benefit nonprofits. So there are models out there where entrepreneurs embed with a nonprofit to maybe improve their tech infrastructure or talk to them about a five-year strategy, things that nonprofits, especially on the smaller side, can't afford. So we're looking to unleash not just the success and capital of entrepreneurs, but also their time and talent.
And there's that intangible sense of setting down roots in a community, right, Doug, for these entrepreneurs and for their team.
Absolutely. I think what we want is really engaged entrepreneurship and engaged, you know, tech community. Actually, many, many years ago, back in, I think, 2009, we did a board training with Neil's old organization. So before he was at the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation, he was part of NEW, or Nonprofit Enterprise at Work, the CEO there. And one of their programs that we participated in was a nonprofit board governance training with the express intent of trying to get more technologists available to serve on local nonprofit boards, because technology is changing every business and every organization in some way. And so we want to make sure, again, that, you know, the organizations around our area could benefit from that closer partnership.
And just to build on Doug's sort of longer-term observation, so I'm born and raised in Ann Arbor, and I remember the Park Davis and Pfizer days, and what I really appreciated about that era was tons of board members and volunteers were coming out of that institution. So when Pfizer up and left, the community asked itself, where are we going to find the talent to govern all of these nonprofits? And frankly, I think the growing tech entrepreneurial base in Ann Arbor is not invisible, but not fully appreciated. And we view those entrepreneurs as one of the centers of a new wave of talent that we can activate to serve on nonprofit boards.
Well, there's not one big building that says Pfizer, and there it is. They're throughout the community, as you say, invisible but not invisible. And also to the point of more volunteers, that is one of the big challenges for nonprofits is getting younger volunteers. The baby boomer generation's kind of moving on, and so you're trying to grow this next generation of volunteers.
Yeah, and actually the challenge is twofold. So absolutely, I'm trying to keep volunteerism high on the list of folks who are obviously busy raising families, busy building businesses. I'll also mention a constant concern among the charitable sector, not just here but anywhere in the country, is who is going to be that next generation of key philanthropists who are really driving community well-being and goodwill. Mm-hmm. And we, again, view that as there's no one big company, as you observed. So part of our job is to find all of those pockets of talent that eventually will become the next generation of philanthropists. And we think that the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund will be one of many strategies to develop that next generation.
So Doug Song, how far have you gotten in recruiting these tech founders to come on board with this effort with Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs?
Well, as you stated, there's not one big building you can point to, and so there's a lot of ground to cover. There are hundreds of companies, actually, in the area, and many more cropping up all the time. And that ultimately, if we're successful, we'll create a new standard of what progressive founders are really aspiring to do with their businesses. And so we'll see. It'll take some time, but excited to have the partnership of not only the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation, but also media platforms like yourselves and others to help us get the word out.
And just this idea that, as you say, it kind of makes your jaw drop to hear there are hundreds of these kind of tech startups in the area. And I suspect for the folks running them, everybody's in their silo. Everybody's trying to make it work, make it work, make it work. What does it mean for these startup folks to come together for the purpose of doing good for the community?
Well, if nothing else, it's a bit of moral support for each other. it's hard work. And, most businesses, whether you're a tech company or you're a small business, the vast majority don't actually last 3 years, right? But to get over that hurdle, it does take a village, right, to raise a company. And so it's important and strategic for our business community in this sector as much as it is for philanthropy, frankly. And so that's something I think we hope to see more of the local investment community, our venture capitalists and others, also take an interest in, because we do believe that a community like this makes for better founders, which ultimately makes for more sustainable, long-term, and ultimately successful companies.
And Cynthia, if I can share two quick anecdotes. One is we spent several years talking to local tech entrepreneurs about what would a value add look like, and we were surprised how many founder CEOs said they really wanted a space to network with their peer founder CEOs. And that, while Doug mentioned there's a lot of ways to meet up, there's not a lot of protected spaces for peer CEOs, not just to talk about the community, but talk about the challenges that they face that others might have answers to. And to illustrate that, at the last meetup we had to sort of launch and talk about the Entrepreneurs Fund, there was a venture capital partner in the room, and he observed that three of the companies he's invested in, who all use AI as a backbone for their work, met for the first time at the meetup and had never met before, despite all being commonly funded by this venture fund. And he said that's a great illustration of the peer-based value that comes with this, in addition to the first motivation, which is community impact.
I guess I'm wondering, could what you're doing with the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund, could this be used as a template for other parts of the state, Doug?
I certainly hope so. I mean, any business like ours, we tend to think of our business in startup mode, growth mode, or scale mode. And this is all very much startup mode. We're early yet, but we do hope that if we're successful, this will grow and we'll have the opportunity to scale this. Because, again, I think tech success happens everywhere. And there isn't a business today that isn't transformed in some way by it. And so we do think that there is tremendous opportunity for the west side of the state, for Detroit and parts north. We've already had some outreach actually from some friends in Detroit that are saying, how quickly can you get here? But just as quickly, I'm encouraging them, well, you can organize there as well, right? It doesn't have to be sort of one organization doing this, and we hope that there are many.
And Neil, what's the take from the philanthropic side of things?
I think there's a lot of excitement and interest. Like Doug said, it's the early days, so of course we want to prove out the concept, make sure it's growing like we think it will. But what I'll mention is the mission of the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation is to benefit Washtenaw County. So when we get into sort of scaling and replication mode, our role is going to be a good partner to other philanthropic platforms in other communities that want to replicate this. And obviously, it's incumbent on us to share any good that we develop here. So we're going to be willing and excited partners to see this spread beyond while we continue to focus on Washtenaw County.
Doug Song, co-founder of Duo Security and the founder of the Ann Arbor Entrepreneurs Fund, and their partner, the Ann Arbor Area Community Foundation, and its president, Neil Hadra. Thank you to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow, school superintendents struggling to plan their budgets for the new school year. That's because the Whitmer administration and state lawmakers have not nailed down the new state budget. We'll find out how school administrators are dealing with budget uncertainty heading into the new school year. That's next time on Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.